Okay, I'd like to welcome you to the February 19th meeting of the California Water Commission. Sue, can we call the roll?
Commissioner Ball, absent, although we are expecting him. Commissioner, or Chairman Byrne?
Here.
Commissioner Curtin, absent. Commissioner Delboski?
Here.
Commissioner Delfino?
Here.
Commissioner Hens?
Here.
Commissioner Orth?
Here.
Commissioner Ortega?
Here.
Commissioner Saracino, absent. We do have a quorum.
Great, thank you very much. Move to item three on the agenda, which is approval of the meeting minutes. Everybody had a chance to look at them?
Yep. Move.
Moved. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Great. Meeting minutes are approved. We'll go to item number five on the report, which is Director Mark Cowan of DBUR. Thank you very much for being here, Director. You're going to give us a briefing on what's going on. You've been incredibly busy, I know, and appreciate taking the time to come update us. And Commissioners Curtin and Ball are here just in time. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to come down and speak with you all. Glad to see I'm such a good draw for you. This morning, you might want to think about your guest list in the future.
Twice the usual crowd.
Anyway, not to diminish those of you that did attend today, thank you for coming. Well, let me just, I'll be brief. I wanted to touch briefly upon what we're doing regarding this historic drought crisis that we're all confronting right now, talk a little bit about the California Water Action Plan, where we are on BDCP, and then maybe a little bit on where we hope to go on groundwater management over the course of the next year. So those are just a few topics that are at least among the top 10 on my to-do list on a day-to-day basis. Well, I think we all know these are pretty extraordinary times, and you know, I get to think the old adage is true: the greater the challenge, the greater the opportunity. And so we are in the opportunity available time. So let's see what we can do to take advantage of it. I think, like most Californians, this severity of this drought caught me by surprise, if you will. Now, certainly we'd been preparing for a dry year from all of 2013 when the storm system cut off back in late 2012. But as usual, we entered the winter with expectations that we'd have a few good storm systems that would replenish our reservoirs and at least move us along like we usually do towards project operations and water supply for all Californians. But if anything, I think that the experience of the last few months has just underscored for me how dependent we are on those two or three or four big storm systems that move through California to replenish our reservoirs, replenish our groundwater basins, and that's what we really depend upon for the majority of our water supplies. So it's a shock when those storms don't appear, and that's certainly what happened during the course of December. We began to consider the need for a drought proclamation in December, worked with the governor to establish the Interagency Drought Task Force at that point in time, and began ramping up in the department and across state government to respond to drought. I personally went off to holiday vacation, assuming that it would rain by the time we got back and we'd be back to business as usual, and now that obviously wasn't the case. So early January, it became very clear that we're going to need a drought proclamation. We're going to have to step up and provide some extraordinary services, and we've been responding ever since then. Of course, the governor did issue his drought proclamation. I believe it was January 17th. Took a little build-up to get there, but we got there at the a drought proclamation that has a dozen or more very specific actions for state agencies to undertake to help respond to drought. And I have to say that it's a wonderful thing when you see government work the way it's supposed to, and so far I couldn't be happier with the way that state government has responded. The Governor's Office of Emergency Services has provided the basic framework of the organization for state agency response, and all state agencies have been working very well together to date. We stepped forward from the drought proclamation, of course, with the announcement that we had to reduce state water project allocation from a minimal 5% down to zero. Did that 2 weeks later on January 31st. And we also petitioned the state board, of course, for a temporary urgency change on the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan requirements to allow us to reduce outflow requirements as of February 1 and also have more flexibility for opening the Delta cross-channel gate. So our goal here has really been to preserve enough water upstream, capture as much water as we can through any storms that we do get in those upstream reservoirs to provide for basic salinity control in the Delta throughout this summer. To the extent that we are fortunate enough to have a few more storms, perhaps we'll be able to step back up project deliveries, but at this point, with every passing day without another significant storm, that seems less and less likely. So we really are in a mode of considering what's going to be necessary to provide for basic public health and safety through the course of the summer and fall, and very much focused on achieving that. Again, I think the cooperation between state agencies, the cooperation between DWR, Reclamation, and the three state and federal fish agencies has been extraordinary to match these extraordinary times. We've been able to continue compliance with the Endangered Species Act to provide for basic protection for fish as we respond, and we will continue to work very closely with all those agencies as well as the state board as we manage project operations through this continuing dry year. Moving on from that, of course, the Interagency Drought Task Force is keeping abreast of emergency situations on local levels as they exist. The Department of Public Health is tracking small communities that are facing water shortages and extending what services we can at the state level to help ameliorate those circumstances. We will continue to do so. Hopefully we'll see that list of communities that face potential water outages in 60 days or 90 days decrease over time. Naturally, I think we'll see communities rotate through as we understand their circumstances and then try to respond. But naturally, if dry conditions continue, we expect that additional communities will pop up on that list and we'll have to respond accordingly. So moving on from drought response, obviously one of our big focuses moving into the fall and winter months last year was preparation of the California Water Action Plan. I hope you all had an opportunity to review and really immerse yourself in it. I personally don't think there's any big surprises in terms of new policy or proposed actions in that plan. What I do think is extraordinary is that it is articulated as boldly as it is, if you will, and it's a product of the collaboration of California Natural Resources Agency, Cal EPA, and the Department of Food and Agriculture. So while I don't think there are any surprises, as I say, in terms of policy direction or proposed actions, I do think it's an extraordinary moment to have all of these agencies within the administration aligned and focused on these actions to be implemented over the next 5 years to, obviously, if we could implement them all, I think we'd be in much better shape when the next drought rolls around in California's future. I will say I think the plan is aspirational. We will need a lot of resources and a lot of luck, essentially, to complete all of the actions within the plan, but I do think it serves as a great guidepost for us as we prioritize and move forward. And I think it's a great backdrop as we respond to drought. We understand that we're not going to drought-proof California. There will always be hardship in times of a historic drought of this nature, but the idea is we've got to prepare, of course, during normal and wet years so that we're better able to face these dry years. So anyway, I think the California Water Action Plan is a very important action by this administration to align our agencies and prioritize our actions. You saw some of that reflected in the governor's budget. Some of the water funding, well, all of the water funding was really organized around the actions within the Water Action Plan, and we hope to continue to advance the plan as we take a breath, hopefully in the future from drought response. I will say that while I think the plan reflects a lot of the evolution that I see among California water managers in terms of policy, in terms of moving towards sustainable, reliable management of our water resources, the plan reflects lack of evolution in terms of how we're going to pay for it. The financing plan is vague, and we know that we need to amplify our efforts to get at how we're going to finance water infrastructure, water programs, if we're going to make any of the Water Action Plan work. So I just happened to be looking at the California Water Commission webpage. Notice that one of your statutory responsibilities is to advise the Director of Water Resources, so I'm here looking for your advice. obviously, these are tough issues. The legislature has dealt with them. Here in the Natural Resources Agency, we've tried to put forward proposals in the past. This gets into the water bond discussion, which no doubt will become more a part of our daily lives moving into spring and summer. But practical advice on how we allocate and finance projects across local, state, federal government, ratepayers, taxpayers, coming up with an approach that is sustainable and works, I think, is the number one challenge we have before us. I think more and more we understand what it is we need to do. We just have to figure out how to get it done, and paying for it, of course, is one of the primary things when it comes to getting it done. I couldn't leave today without talking about the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. I'm frankly as surprised as anybody that this is the third thing I'm talking about today, given my last few years, but we continue to advance the plan. Obviously, the public draft has been out for review now for a couple of months, I believe, with at least a couple months to go. We've held our 12 public meetings. I just heard in the elevator yesterday that we think that we got about 1,000 people total participating in those workshops held around California. So what's that leave, 35, 36 million to go, something like that. So we'll get out there, though, and hopefully continue to educate people on the plan. I think at this point what we continue to focus on in terms of fleshing out the plan is on better defining the obligations of the various parties that would participate in the plan. By that I mean water agencies, state and federal government, how we will allocate costs and risk among those participants, and the form of water assurances that emerge from the plan. Now, all three of those issues are big and they're intermingled, but that really is the primary effort at this point to better define the specifics of just how all of that will work together. And then finally, on groundwater management, another action that was highlighted, and perhaps this is one of the bolder sections of the California Water Action Plan, seems to be a lot of momentum for making improvement in groundwater management. Obviously, drought continued pumping reliance on groundwater this year amplifies concerns in some communities about declining groundwater levels, declining groundwater quality, and perhaps helps provide a call for action. I know Commissioner Orth has been involved in some of the discussions to date. The Brown administration is organizing itself between the State Water Resources Control Board, DWR, and the Department of Food and Agriculture to lead a stakeholder process to really try to gain more input on the potential content of policy for a groundwater management bill this year, and that is on a pretty short track, perhaps 60 days or something like that, to receive public input. I think this is an extraordinary opportunity. I would say that I want to be clear that we shouldn't approach changes in groundwater management as a response to drought. I want to be very clear that we obviously are going to continue to rely upon our groundwater resources in times like this. But again, sustainable groundwater management policy that provides for recharge such that the water supplies are there when we need them during periods of drought is extremely important. The basic framework for improvements in groundwater policy that are laid out in the California Water Action Plan are our starting point, essentially a two-step sort of process. We continue to endorse what has been California's policy now for at least a couple of decades, that groundwater management is best carried out at the local and regional level. We want, as a first step, to be sure that we've provided local agencies the tools they need to be successful in sustainably managing groundwater basins. So tools, mechanisms for financing, whatever we need to do at the state level to align our services to help provide for local water management is our preferred outcome in advancing improved groundwater management. But as a second step, a state backstop for communities that cannot or will not make advancement in improving groundwater management should be a part of the policy, and that's where we start. So lots of detail, obviously a lot of devil in the details, but I think a really extraordinary opportunity for us to make an important step forward in what has been severely lacking portion of California water policy, I believe, this year. So maybe I'll stop there. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you today. Interested in any suggestions or comments or observations you all have for me. Love to hear stories from Commissioner Del Bosque on his his event last week. So I'll stop there and take any questions you might have for me.
Okay, any questions? Commissioner Delfino.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. That was a very good update, and I do not envy you right now. it is pretty extraordinary when you are out on the ground looking at what's going on from all perspectives, human, fish, wildlife, agriculture, ranchers. Everyone's, I think, suffering. And I appreciate the work that the department's doing. I had a couple of just questions. And I'm going to start with BDCP. Do you know when the implementing agreement draft might be released? I only ask because I think it might affect the comment deadline, and it also goes to sort of what parties' responsibilities are. And then the other question I have is if you have any update on progress made on the participating parties in the BDCP in terms of them providing additional financial assistance for the analysis and work to continue, because I think you're coming up on a next sort of phase.
Right. Both great questions. The three issues I talked about, limits and obligations of the parties, financing, assurances, really are the major elements of the implementing agreement, and you know, inside baseball term, but it's an accompanying agreement that goes along with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan that is essentially, I don't know if contract is the right word, but an agreement among the parties as to some of the specifics about the way the plan will actually be implemented. Resolving those three fundamental issues more definitively is going to be necessary to really have a complete implementing agreement. That's our focus. We've got federal agencies coming in next week for a two-day workshop to continue that process. We know we have a 60-day public comment period requirement for providing a draft of the implementing agreement prior to completion of our broader Bay Delta Conservation Plan public review period. So we're bumping up against that date. Of course, at the same time, we're considering the many requests for extension for public comment that we're receiving now. So I'm not going to break any news on that front today, but we will comply with the required public comment period on both fronts. As far as the continued funding for planning for the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, obviously this is a tough issue. We've invested millions and millions, tens of billions of dollars in the program to date. I won't cite a number because I'll get it wrong. But the water agencies that have supported this to date have to know that there's an endpoint out there, that we're going to have a yes or no answer as to if we're moving forward with this plan. So it's incumbent upon us as we resolve those issues that will define the implementing agreement to also consider what other issues stand between us and a yes or no decision on the permit. And we're very focused on doing that. We have funding now that will last us essentially into the summer. to continue the planning process for the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, we will need additional funding to continue beyond that. Some of the bigger water agencies have this issue before their boards right now. It's an extraordinary time to ask particularly ag water districts to pony up or commit to millions more expenditures while they're receiving no water supplies and suffering economic hardship. But we've got to keep our eye on the long view here. We've come so far, and we are so close, that I believe at the end of the day, we will secure the funding to complete the planning process and to move the project forward.
Commissioner Ball.
So I wouldn't purport to give you advice, given that you know more about water than I ever will, but I'll give you my observation. We seem to be reacting to drought, and yet I think we've known for quite some time that our current water plan is not sustainable. So we look at history and realize that we have had much more severe droughts in the past, and if what we're seeing now is not just an intermittent drought, then it would mean that more water storage is not really going to be a long-term answer. I think that as you look at cost, clearly the price that we pay for water is very low, and we're just going to have to get used to paying more for water, particularly in the cities where if we want to see any population growth, or it's not going to be saved by just conservation or reclamation. One of the solutions, and it's a higher cost solution, is desalination. And I would be very interested in sort of getting your take on, as we start to look at the inevitable increases in the price that we pay for water, again, looking at the gross inequities in what agricultural water costs, but looking at the downtown water costs, how does desal figure into that?
Well, I guess a couple of responses. I guess I would call upon the Sunny McPeak in my ear right now and be very clear that I don't think there is a single silver bullet for California water management. Desal will have its role. There are obviously very difficult implementation issues associated with desal, or else we would see more desal plants going in California. Rather than the silver bullet, of course, we're advocating for the silver buckshot. That's Sunny's line, so one of my favorite ones I've heard recently. So we've got to take advantage of all of the opportunities that are in front of us that are specific to each region. In my mind, there are so many opportunities for water reclamation and stormwater management that will essentially provide reliable water supplies at a cheaper cost than desal will right now, with less potential environmental harm, so easier permitting. I think we've got a long ways to go to exhaust those opportunities before desal becomes, you know, really a mainline next step option for California's future. But I'm not diminishing its potential role. Obviously, there are advances seemingly every year on the technology, the cost, the energy associated with it. So we'll continue to nurture those opportunities as well. I think the bigger, more interesting question is, where is the inevitable increase in water costs going relative to agriculture in California? It's very clear that city users can pay for desal, they can pay for recycling. Cost really isn't an issue when it comes down to those types of technologies. But as water costs in general, the market cost of water goes from $10, $20, $50 an acre foot to $400 or $500 an acre foot. What does that mean for California agriculture? I think it's the question of the next few years, and part of the equation when it comes to how are we going to finance water projects in the future, and it's something that we need to confront. Should water be more marketable as one of the solutions? Will we see more high-value crops and perhaps less acreage as a result of higher water costs? All interesting questions, I wish I did have the answers.
Thank you for that. I'd love to hear what your view is on that.
He's got the next question, too. So Commissioner Nebraska.
water costs are certainly being impacted this year on any free water out there. I've heard costs that have gone up 10 times, you know, from normal water cost on the west side of $130 an acre foot. On the open market, they've gone as high as $1,300. That's not sustainable for agriculture. That's desperation, of course, somebody trying to keep their trees alive. So that's definitely going to have an impact this year on people who are trying to buy water to keep their trees alive. It's going to be a huge economic hit for the valley. I'd like to ask Mark two questions. The first one is among the issues that the president came out to talk about, the drought. He also mentioned climate change, and he mentioned he was going to devote about $1 billion to climate change, only maybe 10 or 20 or 50 million for drought, but he had a lot of emphasis on climate change. And I wanted to ask you, what's your take on that? How is that going to help us in a meeting talking about this devastating drought? And he mentions climate change. What does that mean to you?
Well, far be it from me to criticize the president. When I read the stories in the paper, I was surprised that that seemed to be sort of the lead line as well, however. For me, whether or not this particular moment is a result of longer-term climate change or an anomaly in the record that we've seen over the past 500 years, I don't care. We've got to respond to the situation. We know we have a variable Mediterranean water climate. We're not sure exactly how that translates in the future, but if we could solve the equation such that we have a reliable water supply based upon the known uncertainty and record over the past 100 years, that would be a great advancement in California water policy. And that would position us well for whatever happens in terms of longer-term climate change.
Okay. One more question. Yeah. The other question was, obviously he came to our location because we're at ground zero of the drought, zero water supply for the CVP, zero water supply for Fryant, zero water supply for the State Water Project that makes up literally all of the South San Joaquin Valley. What is zero water supply to the State Water Project going to do to the finances, the financial situation of the department?
Well, we'll be fine. Fortunately, the way our water supply contracts work, we recapture all of our costs, no matter how much water we deliver. Now, of course, we're very concerned about the way that affects our member agencies. Obviously, it will have less impact on Southern California water users and their ability to pay than it will in Kern County, for instance. So we're going to have to monitor that situation, see what we can do to help out financially. One thing we were able to do recently was to release some funding, some of the ag rate management funding that is held in trust each year. We were able to release that money can't remember the exact total, but something on the order of $20 million. So we could release that a couple months early to Kern County to help them deal with the economic pinch they're feeling right now. If it comes to deferring costs, we have provisions in our contracts for doing that. So we'll continue to monitor just how it plays out. Obviously, we continue to be concerned about not just this dry year, but what happens if we have continued dry years and decreased water supplies, and that's where we may really see a potential impact on financing the state project if this condition continues for several more years.
Are you able to pass that on without tacking it on to water the way it normally goes? I'm mostly in the Central Valley project, and of course, we pay through our O&M when we are delivered water.
Right.
We don't deliver water, we don't pay O&M.
Right.
So is that the same situation with the State Water Project?
We pass on fixed costs regardless of how much water we actually deliver. Now, I guess the good news is we're not spending a whole lot of money on energy costs and operation and maintenance since we're not moving a lot of water over the hatcheries at this point. Mm-hmm. But the bills will continue to go out, and regardless of whether we deliver 0 or 100% of our entitlement, we continue to pay for the costs for the project.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword there. Mm-hmm. What about generation of power and with the reservoirs being this low?
Right.
That has to be an impact, too.
Absolutely, yeah. A big decline in hydropower this year, and that will mean drawing on other sources of energy this year, which in turn have greenhouse gas impacts, and the cycle continues.
So it's just not the decline of power sources, it's the use of power to draw the water out of the aquifer.
True, true.
I understand it's almost equivalent to the amount of power that you will lose in the hydropower process. So it's actually double the cost.
Very true.
Commissioner Ortega, you want
to? Thank you, Mr. President. I think one of the things that strikes me most about the financing of water, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I wholeheartedly agree with you that it's the driver for how we resolve problems, is the surprises that come with water management. So, for example, I've been involved in surveying agencies down in Southern California, and as we have been promulgating in California several water quality regulations, there were many entities that were not concerned with certain constituents because they felt that they were below the proposed MCLs. What's happening is that as you draw groundwater lower in the basins, the concentrations increase, and all of a sudden they're very concerned. And the costs to deal with it are enormous. The state has been making headway in addressing issues with small disadvantaged communities on the arsenic and nitrate standards, for example, which is at about $1 billion if everything gets spent right. The cost for some of these emerging standards is going to be $4 billion. So that's one surprise. Is there any possibility that in this alignment that the water plan has inspired that you mentioned, that there could be greater thought to that? Because, for example, with arsenic, I guess the regulation was delayed 5 years in order to accommodate the necessary capital. And then we have other regulations that would require the same thing in the middle of a drought. Not to suspend regulations, but to simply be more strategic about the way they're implemented.
Right. Well, I think that's a great question and comment. One of the themes within the Water Action Plan is encouraging state agencies to better align regulation mm-hmm. to work with the services the state agencies provide in a more coherent, strategic way. Now, that's easier to say than to do, but I think, you know, pointing to the problem and encouraging the kind of communication and cooperation that we've had among state agencies in developing the plan, if we can sustain that as we develop and implement the plan, we'll have more opportunities for that kind of alignment. But a great challenge.
And the second cost factor that I've been thinking, or a financial factor, is the value of water. So, for example, you know, the state contractors are very diligent about the state's activities on the State Water Project, and they want flexibility in the system. Yet when you look at individual systems of the contractors, they don't have that flexibility. I live in a place, for example, that celebrates that we're using less water than we did in the 1970s, and that we have all kinds of great things going, but it's impossible to move water that's been saved, you know, from one part of the system to another. And then also when it comes to investments in conservation, you know, we have this quandary that the water isn't valued for what it's worth. You know, there's an incentive that's given that's well below the value of the actual water had you had to replace it. So I'm hoping that as you progress in this dialogue with the other agencies that perhaps we start valuing water, at least in some of the urban areas, for what it's really worth.
I, in turn, will ask you to consider that as you develop the advice you're going to provide me on future financing for water in California.
All right, Director. We have one more quick question from Commissioner Orr.
I guess I can't take up, miss the opportunity to talk about groundwater. I guess I wanted to ask a quick question. I agree with you that there's an opportunity here. I also find it challenging for us to think that we need to be deliberative in what we're going to do in advancing groundwater policy, but doing it in a very short time frame. And somehow I think we need to either disconnect or sequence the priority and the emergency issues from the longer-term policy opportunities. My question is, there are a number of areas in the state that are unmanaged, that they don't have active groundwater management plans, and yet there's a tremendous ag conversion or other, you know, conversion going on that's affecting groundwater resources there. And so those of us who are managing groundwater are bearing that burden, frankly, here politically and in other areas. Does the department have resources or a plan today to assist those unmanaged areas in kind of coming up to an appropriate level of management? And how can we help move that along?
Yeah. Well, I have no doubt that we can better organize ourselves to help provide for those types of services among the resources we have now. But I would not go as far as to say is that we have the capability to take on the responsibility. You know, I think that's something that we need to consider as we advance the legislation. What additional authority or resources should any state agency have to help in the broader program? There's a lot of interest right now in drought response. Obviously, Senator Steinberg is introducing his drought bill today, and there will be funding in there, I expect, for additional groundwater activities at the state level. So defining what those programs are and how we can best use them and towards that broader policy objective, I think, will be important. But more work to do to have all the pieces in place to execute whatever plan that we put together.
Okay, Director Cowan, thank you so much for coming in again. We really appreciate you. Obviously, even one of these issues on their own would be a full plate for you. So you seem to be doing a very excellent job, and I was on that conference call where you had other agencies on, and the coordination seems really great. So anything that we can do to help, and appreciate taking the time and educating us on what you're doing and where we are, and we can go on and on, but we won't because we know you're busy and got to get back to these things. So,
well, thank you very much for your time and for your service, and look forward to working with you.
Okay, thank you very much again. Appreciate it. Okay, moving quickly to item 4 on the agenda, which is the Executive Officer's Report.
Great. Just a couple of quick things, because I'm doing two items toward the end of this agenda that I'll also speak about. I did want to mention that I had been invited and attended the board meeting of the Sites Reservoir JPA in January. They were interested both in the Commission's work and the status of our regulations and guidelines, and so I was able to talk to them very generally about that. The State Water Project Annual Review, which you had a few edits to, was finalized after January's meeting, and we have submitted that both to the Director of GWR, to Resources Natural Resources Agency, and to the Legislature. As I think you are all aware, we're working with AQUA and with the Delta Stewardship Council on a survey that will go out to local and regional agencies regarding near-term water storage and water efficiency projects. That's being beta tested this week by a couple of individuals and agencies, and we hope to distribute that starting next week. And then finally, in your binders, I believe in the back page, is a summary both of the current bond and of three legislative proposals. Rachel Belante went through and did a comparison here. I know Casey will probably talk about this as well in his presentation here in a few minutes, but I just did want to draw your attention to that. And I will hold my other comments on two other issues till we get to those agenda items. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sims. Okay, moving to number 6 on the agenda, which is the update on DWR's Tribal Consultation Program. Anicita Agustinas, DWR Tribal Policy Advisor. Thank you very much for being here and taking the time to let us know what you're doing.
That's my pleasure. Thank you. Commissioners and members of our audience and people online, I'm here to do a brief update on our current activities of the Office of the Tribal Policy Advisor for Department of Water Resources. As you know, my name is Anicita Agustinas. I'm a tribal citizen of the Dene Nation, and many of you may recognize that in a more familiar term as Navajo Nation. I'm a member of my traditional clan of Tortichitney, which is bitter water. So I report directly to our Chief Deputy Director, Laura King Moon, and Mark Cowan, our director, and I provide them policy advice and recommendations as it relates to the tribal community. One of my main tasks and duties when I was hired in August was to develop tribal consultation policy for the Department of Water Resources. So I've created some basic slides. I won't take a lot of your time. The slides are information is to provide you some various background on tribal engagement, sort of where we are with tribal engagement, how it's begun, you know, differences between federally recognized and non-federally recognized tribal governments, the origins of tribal engagement with government-to-government consultation, and, of course, where we are specifically to the Department of Water Resources. So as California citizens, we're faced with the challenges of the current drought situation, and there's no greater challenges to all of California as we work together to reach the goals, you know, providing the basic fundamental needs of water supply and protection of natural assets. And this is, you know, not only for our generations, but current generations to come. So as board members, you crisscross a variety of California's tribal citizen interests, not only on their ancestral territorial homelands, but on their current territorial homelands. Many of you represent districts and counties and supervisors, and you're very familiar with that. And as we talk as a state government agencies, we always rely on local regional resources, and that's where many of our tribal communities reside. And so I'm very proud to say that as you know, caretakers of California's cultural landscape, you know, and our natural resources, we share that common interest in advocacy on behalf of California's tribal citizens. Many of you probably are quite familiar with some of the terms of federally recognized or non-federally recognized. I don't know quite sure how much detail we need to go into, but California is very, very distinct and unusual across the United States landscape when it comes to tribal governments. You know, we have the second largest population in the United States, second to Oklahoma, and following us is Arizona. We have over, across the United States, there's 566 federally recognized tribes. California has 114. Out of that 114, you probably heard figures of 109, 111, 110 in some of our publications in the last 4 years. Four or five of those tribes have only been reinstated within the last 7 years. And there's 70 tribes already in active processes through our various congressional mandates to get re-recognized and reinstated. So there's probably out of that 50 to 70 tribes that have been fighting for the last 25, 30 years, some tribes just fighting within the last 10 years. That alone, again, is another unique feature to California because of the termination, the relocation, and some of our termination policies that really affected California's tribal citizens because of just our what we have unique to California, the gold rush, the land grab, and, of course, just being, you know, where it is on our map as being such a beautiful place. And we see that with our California population. There's federally recognized Indian tribe list is on the California Federal Register. That is a current annual update of every tribe that is current on the federally recognized list. To get a current list of a state federally recognized and non-federally recognized list, we always look to the Native American Heritage Commission. So that is a group here in California that has puts our list together for California, and that is under the definitions of what is a California Native American tribe. Our publications and what we do in California is we have a definition of California Native American tribes that recognizes not only federally recognized tribes, but also non-federally recognized tribes based on what our policies are or what our various divisions are. So that is one of the challenges of tribal consultation, is are we talking and is the invitation to a federally recognized tribe or a non-federally recognized tribe. We have that conversation outside of government, dealing with the tribal groups directly, and it's it's always, as you know, in your communities, a very, very particular concerns. When we're looking at California consultation across the board, we have the unique items for California also looking at individual trust lands, allotment lands, restricted status, and, of course, state Indian reservations. So some of the links I provided in my slides and some of the federal statutes will provide more information on those particular topics and those particular definitions. So government to government is what brings us here and what brings my position to Department of Water Resources. Government to government, and sometimes, you know, we get exasperated state government officials, like, why bother? You know, that's their federal agency. We're a state agency. And so some of the earlier slides establishes why government to government is important, why tribes in California particularly are not considered and are offended by sometimes the terms we use in our publications as stakeholders or as a particular interest, or are they a special interest party. And so what my job is to do is developing our consultation policy that includes or provides enough sensitivity to our internal policies and directions, and also making that bridge to tribal governments. There's quite a divide given historical background and just some of the historical relations we have. But what's really bringing our communities together now, obviously in times of crisis, you have to come together. And what I have been doing across the state is developing consultation meetings. Even though Department of Water Resources does not have a specific tribal consultation policy, we fall under the umbrella of our executive order from Governor Brown in September 2011, an executive order B-1011. That established the Office of the California Tribal Advisor, Ms. Cynthia Gomez, a member of the Tule River Tribe. Very well-respected elder in our community, very well-respected by her tribal community, and also long history of service to state government through her work with Caltrans, Cal-EPA, and as a tribal court judge. So she is really someone that has really broken some barriers in terms of consultation of what she's done with Caltrans. So a lot of our state agencies, the 11 state agencies, look to the Caltrans model as sort of a very good standard to draw upon. Every agency is doing something different and specific to what they need to do. But Governor Brown's Executive Order B-1011 mandates that every state agency develop a tribal consultation policy. So out of the 11 state agencies, probably about four of them are actually in existence, and the other six are currently in process. California, and of course, under the state agencies, for instance, we're under Department of Natural Resources, their tribal policy was developed in November 2012. So as a department under agency, we still look under that umbrella. So I'm very comfortable going out to our tribal communities and letting them know that our consultation that we are working on at Department of Resources falls under the executive order of the governor as well as agency, and as we do our various consultation. Since October, we've done various introductory consultations and also some emergency consultations. For instance, in November, we did our very first tribal consultation on the Lake Paris dam remediation project. That had to deal with a remediation project dealing with a potential release of the channels for an earthquake levels. The tribes down, there was 11 tribes contacted that reside within that ancestral territorial homeland. Five tribes were very interested, and out of those five tribes, they deferred to the three main tribes. So we met with Morongo, Saboba, and Pechanga, and we're continuing to work out some cultural monitoring resources development policy, which does not exist now. A big challenge is cultural resources, and probably foremost to every Native American tribal member. As we go into the drought and we're looking at historical levels of our reservoirs and lakes and streams being down to the very, very lowest they've been probably since some of these dams were ever even created, we're running across a lot of ancestral remains being uncovered that were never unearthed. So we're looking, and tribes are very, very concerned about that. So I'm working with our department and Division of Engineering and our environmental scientists on actually looking at how do we develop policy and procedure. When you're looking at some of our state projects, which is, for instance, Lake Paris, that's a partnership with our state and federal agencies. When you have the state and federal agencies on a particular project, then you have to go into, you know, the federal requirements of consultation, which is long established, and you're looking at NEPA and CEQA issues, and you're also looking at federal 106 state consultation requirements. We will defer to that, but we work closely with them. And so and that also falls under some of the problems that we're having with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. That area also, not only to the Delta-specific area, but the entire Bay Delta channels, as well as some of where we are channeling waters from the headwaters, and the tribes that are very, very concerned, for instance, Hoopa and Klamath, and the tribes up in the Northern Territories. I have worked with our federal state partners, NOAA, about 5-6 of our contracting agencies for our very first introductory tribal consultation on December 10th. We held that at the state Secretary of State Auditorium. We invited every tribe in California, and that was a full invitation to state, federally and non-federally recognized tribes. There was over 110 participants. There was about maybe 40 tribes represented, and very lively questions and answers. But it was 2 days before the public release of the EIR/EIS documents. So tribes are concerned about, well, you've been working on this for how many years? Have you ever met with us, et cetera? That type of conversation, which had not had happened. So in addition to the 12 public meetings that Director Mark Cowan discussed that we just completed, we're working on 3 specific tribal consultations dealing with Bay Delta conservation plans. I've selected a northern regional territory up in the northern area. We'll do a Delta regional one and a Central Valley tribal consultation, and these are scheduled for late April, early May, and those will be specific to the Bay Delta conservation plan in addition to the cultural resources work that we're doing. The other thing that I do want to talk about is our California water plan update and what we do and I've gone all over my slides at this point. The California water plan update. The California water update has had a very long and strong commitment to the tribal community. It began in 2005 when at a public advisory committee there was some tribal interests wanting to be involved, and through the stewardship of some of our directors and chiefs, for instance, Kami Argovici, and the work that he's done of incorporating tribal engagement. It began with a tribal communication plan, and now we have a tribal advisory committee that has helping with our California water plan update. The committee itself sunsets with the governor's approval of the 2013 California Water Plan update, and as we go forward to the 2018 California Water Plan update, my job will be helping with recruitment of a new tribal advisory committee, the recruitment process, and continuing with that committee, which is only specific to the California Water Plan. Members of the outside tribal community get confused thinking they're part of the tribal advisory committee, and they think they're advising all of DWR. However, that's specific to just the California Water Plan. And so we do need other advisory committees, and maybe in a larger sense, to advise us on all these other things that we're doing, especially with cultural resources, because that is really, really a strong touch point with our community, and something that's always going to happen when you're always having to do what we're doing with projects that we do here in California. Some of the later slides here is actually the governor's executive order is an attachment link and a natural resources agency policy. I've also am circulating within our internal department a tribal engagement policy that I'm hoping to have our directors utilize as sort of a procedure guideline for all our divisions and managers and DWR staff to understand why tribal engagement is important. We hear from the community that they don't have access to grants, they're not invited to commission meetings, et cetera, type of thing. So the whole idea is of making certain information very, very transparent. We're developing my website for the tribes. I work very closely with all the other state tribal liaisons. I'm on the drought management team for DWR, and with that drought management, we just conducted our very first tribal statewide conference call on February 7th, and we're developing a tribal communication plan to include tribes in the drought. Drought, is, of course, is one of our most important immediate needs at the moment. Hoopa Tribe, the Kurok Tribe, and the Tule River Tribe have declared state of emergencies. There are several other tribes pending at the moment, and what they'll do. Some of them are waiting to work with their local counties as well as some of their other regional boards. So there's quite a few things happening along the drought management and what we're doing with that. So I don't want to take more of your time, and I do appreciate this opportunity, and I'm happy to return at any moment with your invitation to keep you updated as we continue on. But if you have any questions, I'm available.
Any questions from commissioners? I want to say thank you, and I actually did some work years back with the Native American Heritage Commission a little bit. I don't know if Larry Myers is still...
Yeah, he's in retirement now that Cynthia Gomez is there. So she wears the hat as tribal advisor as well as executive secretary to the Native American Heritage Commission.
Yeah, well, I clearly know your stuff very well, and it's very impressive, and I know that there are complicated issues with tribes, and there's some interesting thing going on with water rights right now as well, and I think having a liaison and having someone working with them closely for DWR is a very positive thing. So appreciate coming in and educating us, and barring any other questions, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to number 7 on the agenda, which is a state budget update, and that's Drew McFarland, who's the chief of DWR budget office. Not sure if I got your name right, Mr. McFarland. I apologize. Okay. Thank you for coming. And after hearing from Director Cowan about how we're going to pay for all these things, I'd be curious to hear from you.
Yeah, sometimes we feel like we're miracle workers sometimes when it comes to funding. Also, a good sign you've been working with numbers too long is I'm not used to glasses, but now I get to the joy of having to wear them. So, well, good morning, members of the commission. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to come in here this morning and present to you the overall budget for DWR. Again, my name is Deward McFarlane, and I am the budget officer for the department. I'm also here this morning with our deputy director over business operations, Kathy Kashaba. So just to kind of give you a quick overview, and a kind of the governor's January budget included $3.8 billion and approximately 3,500 positions to support DWR. This is a little bit over 6% over prior year. We would like to just to kind of give you an overview of how that breaks out, and let's make sure I push this correctly so you can see how that budget breaks down. Obviously, the largest portion, $1.9 billion, is the state water project, which is approximately almost 50% of our budget, followed by electric power, which is $956 million, about 25%. And then we're looking at our general obligation bonds at $744 million, 19.6%. And then we have our reimbursement special funds at $105 million. And coming in last is our general fund at $101 million. And approximately $45 million of that is for the paternity lawsuit, which will be finishing up here very soon within the next year, 2015. In terms of the overall budget process, we are getting into our budget hearing time of year, and currently our Senate Subcommittee Number 2 and the Assembly Subcommittee Number 3 hearings are set for mid-March, and this will be our first opportunity to present our proposals and our budget and get perspective back from the legislature. Four areas of concern or issues that we believe that will be of interest to the legislature is in our proposals, we have what's called the, it's easier to say CASGEM, but it stands for California Statewide Groundwater Elevation Monitoring Program Continued Implementation and Online Well Completion Report Submission System. CASGEM is much easier. This is requesting general fund. It's been a while since the department's asked for a substantial amount of general fund. However, because of that, we do believe that this will be questioned in the hearings. Primarily, as you heard the director talk about drought, this is continued monitoring of wells and groundwater within California, approximately 515 groundwater basins throughout the state, and also providing funding for an online reporting system, which currently is in development. The second issue is the greenhouse gas emission reductions through water energy efficiency programs. This is cap and trade funds. As you may or may not be aware, this has been kind of a political issue, and as expected, as we get into the hearings, we've already had some pre-hearings with the Senate on the overview of cap and trade funding. As we get into our individual hearings with the subcommittees, that will get into program specific and department specific. For DWR, we're getting $20 million over 2 years, with half of that being split to state water project for our Hyatt Thermalito turbine unit upgrades, obviously generating efficiencies, using less energy and producing more energy, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The other $20 million is going to disadvantaged communities through our grant program. So this is also for leak detection, water efficiencies as well. Again, the overall here is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Third issue is our IRWM, Integrated Regional Water Management Grant Program. It's $472.5 million. This is for our third and final round of grants. This was an issue last year. We actually requested the funding last year in the budget process, and it was denied. The LAO, the Legislative Analyst Office, played a huge role. This year, we're in a better situation to move forward with that final rollout, but we do expect it to be an issue to come up during our hearings. The fourth issue is the department is in the process of developing a workplace safety program. This is asking for 23 additional new positions. Obviously, whenever we request positions, it does raise an issue with the legislature wanting to know why. This is to put in place for the department our safety program to make it safe not just for our employees, but for contractors as well as visitors to our facilities located throughout the state. We are currently in the process of the spring finance audit process. Usually April 1st is when that is released. That will also be another opportunity for us, not just with the hearings, but also another opportunity for us to share with the legislature and communicate with them additional requests that the department will have. And at a later date, I can provide that information to you through another presentation, or I can provide that information to Sue Sims. So at that point, I will open it up for any questions that you may have.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions, commissioners? Commissioner Curtin?
The electric power portion?
Yes.
Is that for purchase of electric power? Or?
Yeah, it's our surge program. It had to do when back in 2000, 2001, when the privately held energy power companies were not able to, basically were going to go and become insolvent. Mm. The governor appointed DWR to go in and basically purchase the power for those companies. That's what that funding is. It's getting smaller as that is continuing to wind down. It is much more of that power purchasing, and now it's being turned back over to the privately held power companies.
I sort of get it. So we're using state money to purchase power to do what?
It was a bond. It was an actual bond that was passed. Yeah. It was a revenue bond. It was a bond to provide the money basically for the state to purchase the power for those statewide.
So we're paying back the bond, or we're purchasing power?
The bond's being paid back.
So we're not purchasing power?
We are not purchasing power, no.
Okay. That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is. It was actually a lot more, but yeah, and that is, I can't remember the actual final date for when the bond will be finished, paid back. Okay.
Commissioner Delfino and then Commissioner Bell.
I had a question about the $472 million for the Integrated Regional Water Management Program. So what was the issue last year, and what are you proposing to do with that money this year? Are you making changes to how that funding was supposed to go out?
At this time, no changes are being made to the $400 that would be going out. Mm-hmm. Last year, the issue that was brought by the LAO was just in Phase 2 and where we were in the process of Phase 2. They believed what ended up happening was funding was provided for the state operations side, the development, the ongoing guidelines to be set up for the grants. At that time, they felt that the department was not ready to go with Phase 3 and the final phase, so they withheld that funding, again giving us the state operations to continue development. However, this go-around, the department is ready to move forward on the third and final phase. So primarily, it was a timing issue, is what their biggest issue that they had.
I'm sorry, a timing issue in what way? They just didn't think you guys were ready to issue
to do the
solicitation?
The idea was to give the department the funding now. They figured, well, come back and see us next year when you'll be hopefully in a better situation, positioned to expend the funds and push them out through the grant process.
Okay, and so prior phases, you guys have already spent out those grants?
By the end of this fiscal year, most of those grants for phase two will be out.
Okay. All right, and I just had one other quick question then. On the CASGEM funding, mm-hmm. So is that money just to go to existing wells that you guys are monitoring? Are you doing any new monitoring? And the reason why I ask that is with the amount of groundwater that will likely be pumped this year because of the drought, I'm wondering if you are if you're paying particular attention to certain areas and even maybe around areas where subsidence around state water project infrastructure is a real concern?
That actually is a very good question, of which I would have to, I can provide back to you exactly those details. The understanding, what I know, is it's a continuation, mm-hmm. and a lot of the work that's also done is through volunteers throughout, that's where we get into the online system currently. It's a paper operation where mm-hmm. volunteers provide the information in a database. Again, it all has to be hand-keyed, but an online system would provide those volunteers to be able to provide it online. It wouldn't have to come in the form of paper. As far as is it going to include additional groundwater basins, that I do not know, but I can get that information for you. And again, I can provide that through Sue Sims.
Thank you.
Yep. Commissioner Ball.
Given that you have a comprehensive safety program currently in place, what happened to cause you to add 23 new positions? Where will those positions be located? Will those individuals be out at the different areas? And what is the total cost of these 23 new positions?
So the total cost is, pardon me just a minute here, I do believe I have that. The 23 positions, exactly that. They would be located throughout the state, the various facilities that we have. One of the reasons why the number of positions we're asking for is a substantial number. And hold on, let me just get the dollar here for you real quick. And you know what? I do not have the total dollar amount with me. I thought I had brought it. But I can provide that to you. Basically, it equates out to, obviously, because the safety program would be part of our overhead, so it would be administered and distributed out through our overhead. But to answer your question, the 23 positions would be located throughout the state at the various facilities. One of the reasons, obviously, is to have them centrally located. Having a person travel all over the state, given the diversity of the department, it wouldn't make sense. Basically, this came into play. We've had a couple incidents that had happened. I don't know if you're familiar with down the Delta with one of the diving incident that happened where a diver had, with intakes, basically drowned. Was one of the reasons. Also, the Oroville facility, the dam. We had the tunnel incident that happened where several people were injured. And primarily, those were the biggest drivers as to one of the reasons why, as individuals go down to do work, whether it be contractors or our employees or if someone was visiting, that certain precautions be taken before they go in. And if you ever go into one of the facilities, you can see it's not just one switch. It's multiple things and safety checks that need to be in place before people go in. And to make sure that you have that overview, that someone who has the experience can make sure that all that is in place and those safety precautions are taken before employees go in there, that's one of the major reasons why this push for the safety program.
So they'll be assigned to the projects that are ongoing in different facilities, but will they also be in facilities where there are no projects going on?
That's correct. They'd be located throughout our regional offices that we have, as well as those facilities, and they may be located, they may be in a place where there is no current project going on, but you also have maintenance. You have anytime there's a maintenance issue where, in both those incidents, those were maintenance issues where they went in and safety was, it just takes one person. If they overlook something as simple as a switch can be catastrophic in some cases, which those two instances were two examples.
Okay. I've got one quick question. The $1.9 billion for the state water project, how does that work? Do the contractors pay all that, or how does that work?
That basically is through the contractors, which basically would be the water users, and that benefit
right.
Also pay that. That is correct.
Okay.
As we refer to it as off-budget.
Got it. And that includes salaries of people working on the project?
That is correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. That's
thank you very
a very
much.
Helpful document to have as well going forward.
And
good luck on the budget
provide
committee.
That information as well, that additional those questions that you have.
That'd be great. Yeah, thank you for the follow-up. Got it. All right. Thanks again, Ms. McFarland.
Thank you.
Okay, number 8 on the agenda is legislative update with Casey Shemke. Welcome, Casey. So is the bond all wrapped up and ready to go? Full $3 billion for
us? No comment. Good morning again. My name is Casey Shemke. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Water Resources. I don't have a wonderful PowerPoint presentation for you today, in part because this coming Friday, the 21st, is actually the deadline for the introduction of legislation in this legislative year. I do believe you have in your packets a quick three-page summary of some of the water legislation that has popped up already thus far. And I was just going to maybe quickly have a look at a couple of those for you. Some are what we would refer to as perhaps unartfully as spot bills, the ones you see that refer to making technical, non-substantive changes or stating legislative intent. What I was going to point out for you a couple of things, obviously from a departmental perspective, recently introduced legislation by Assemblymember Frazier on the first page, 1671, that relates to the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and in particular the construction of tunnels or facilities relating to that. It would require an affirmative action of the legislature before anything could happen on that. That bill was recently introduced. There was and I'm drawing a blank, there was similar legislation in, I believe, 2009 that did not proceed anywhere. But I'm sorry, the bill number escapes me at the moment. So this is similar to what we've seen before. One thing of interest on page 2 that we have talked about previously or in past years, AB 148 relates to the salt and sea restoration. Last year, Assemblymember Perez had AB 71. This bill, AB 148, makes some technical changes to that language. So we've been working with the author on that also. Couple of water quality related things and also relating to the department's Integrated Regional Water Management Program. Second item on page 2, AB 1249. By Assemblymember Salas relates to nitrates contamination. Essentially, it would ask integrated regional water management plans when a portion of the geographic boundary of that plan touches a nitrates high risk area, which is a definition the board is working on, or a mapping area that the board is working on, would require the plan to basically state how it's addressing that problem. And then if projects that are submitted to DWR for funding through the IRWM program address or attempt to address partly that problem, it would require us to give it a preference for funding. Similarly, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to, or maybe back. It's actually back, I'm sorry, AB 1731. By Assemblymember Perea also relates to our Integrated Regional Water Management Program. It would declare a 10% of any funding go to projects that benefit disadvantaged communities. This is not dissimilar from what we have seen previously. Previously, this language was included with an actual appropriation. Obviously, in the situation we're dealing with, as Dewar just pointed out, we're requesting the remainder of the Prop 84 IRWM funding, so this would, assumably apply to that funding and potentially any future funding that the department might get. As you are all, I'm sure, well aware, there are a few bonds that have been proposed and out there. Just running through those really quickly, we've got AB 1331 by Assemblymember Rendon, We've got AB 1445 by Assemblymember Logue. We've got SB 848 by Senator Wolk, which is essentially very similar to her SB 42 from last year, and it was just amended last week in committee. So there was some changes to it there. And a recently introduced SB 927 by Senators Cannella and Videk. Those are the four main bond proposals currently out there. There is, I think, one additional spot bill that declares legislative intent to make changes to the bond that's currently set to go before the voters in November. Two items that popped up this morning that are not on this list, and I was just going to give you a quick heads up. I'm on page 3 of the document. At the last one on the item, actually, there was a typo here. It should be SB 985, Stormwater Resource Planning, by Senator Pavley. Senator Pavley also had two bills that were introduced yesterday, SB 1036, which relates to urban water management plans and identifying the energy content of their water use, of an urban area's water use, and SB 1049, and again, my apology, I just saw it this morning, but it appears to me that it would explicitly declare that projects that could reduce the energy content of water use would be eligible projects under the IRWM program. So those just popped up this morning, and I wanted to make sure I noted those for you as well. So again, we'll probably see a few more bills introduced here today, tomorrow, and Friday, which is the deadline for bill introductions for the year. You do have the water bond comparison that I believe was in your packet that was put together by the commission staff. Just a couple of notes that might be of interest to you that I was going to point out, specifically to the water storage piece that obviously relates to the commission's activities. In these, you've got the SB 927, AB 1445, and SB, the Cogdill bond, the existing bond, that deal with the continuous appropriation piece of funding. SB 848 by Senator Wolk, that bill is silent. It talks about the funding being available to the commission, which generally, by definition, means it would need to be appropriated by the legislature for use. And just an interesting piece, AB 1331 by Assemblymember Rendon directs it to the Water Commission, but then it appropriates $300 million a year in each of the five fiscal years. So there are different ways of writing continuously appropriated. You can declare it. It can say without reference to fiscal year. I believe this is a continuous appropriation of $300 million a year, but I am not a lawyer, and so I will defer to others. But it also does then say the legislature can supplement that with additional appropriations in any given year. So that might be of interest or something that you may want to look at as well. So those are just some of the notes on these that I was going to point out to you.
Thank you, Casey. It's very helpful, and thank you to commission staff and Casey for the grid, which I think is helpful as well to give us a sense. I have a quick question, not on the bond, but on this one by Brown, not being able to water your lawn or not being able to require. That's interesting. I've seen that in a lot of cities where they have ordinances that require grasses to be green and all that.
There was legislation in, I believe, 2009, by then assembly member, I think it was Ted Liu, that dealt with homeowners associations and invalidating any homeowners association provision that said you could not use low water use landscaping or you could not comply with a local decision that you need to stop watering your lawn. So we've seen that previously. I don't know the extent of the problem. As you just pointed out anecdotally, you've heard of this before. I'm not familiar with the breadth of the problem that this is addressing, but I think it's one of those kind of common sense pieces, especially in a year like this when we are dealing with a severe drought and and uncertain how the future will unfold with regard to our water needs. And landscaping, outdoor landscaping does tend to, you know, comprise
the majority.
A significant piece of water use in the state. So this is, I think, an interesting item.
Yeah, I think that'll be an interesting thing that the League of Cities may, who knows what position they'd take, but there are a lot of cities that have local ordinances and they prosecute people for not keeping up their house and having a green lawn is one of them. But questions for any commissioners? Commissioner Ortega?
Yeah, just on your question, Mr. President, there was a story of the city of Lawndale, it's literally called Lawndale, out by the LA airport, that fined people a few years ago for tearing out their lawns. Their name is Lawndale, but they've since seen the light and they're doing a lot on conservation now. My question to you, there's a lot of focus in the legislature on disadvantaged communities, and there was last year as well. And there's numbers that are thrown out to address infrastructure and the needs in those communities. Where are the numbers coming from? Like, is there a study? I've looked through the American Society of Civil Engineers to see if they've called out the kind of infrastructure that's required for disadvantaged communities. Or is the department offering any resources to the legislature as they come up with these numbers? To me, for example, when we look at what's being done on the nitrate issue or the arsenic issue, there's going to be a big grab for what little money there is to address other constituents that are going to be regulated, as I've been mentioning over the past several months. And so to settle for these amounts for these communities may end up shortchanging them because it's not, there's just a lot of demand for that money that bigger entities may be competing for. So I'm just interested, are there resources in the department or somewhere in the state, maybe the state board, that's providing the data that is being used in this legislation to say, okay, 10%, you know, for earwump and, you know, X amount in these other areas?
I don't know that it's a central location where the information is coming from. Mm-hmm. Obviously, through the Department of Finance and economic information, we can identify where a disadvantaged community based on economics is located. Mm-hmm. We then have the issue of, at least from a Department of Water Resources and Integrated Regional Water Management Program perspective, it's an issue. It has been an issue of with a critical drinking water supply need. So you may have a disadvantaged community that is hooked up to a municipal supply and does not have the same need as a disadvantaged community that is not and is on groundwater with a nitrates problem or other contaminants and the likes of that. The larger infrastructure, I would have to say, and I don't know this for certain, but I would have to say it's probably somewhat pieced together on local information about planning needs, yeah, overlaying that with economic data.
Yeah, but what happens is that if those needs are coming from a specific area, say a legislator is in the Central Valley or in Southern California, and they're using their area to say, okay, well, this is what my area needs, therefore this is what the rest of the state might need. I mean, for example, in Southern California, you know, we're talking about conserving water. And, you know, when you look at what the agencies do, it's, you know, low-flow toilets, the shower heads, you know, what you typically hear about. But in greater and greater portions of the region, the greatest water savings would be from fixing old systems. If you go to the communities of Huntington Park and Maywood and all of these places in Southeast LA where the majority of the people live in the county, they're not going to be overwatering their lawns. The problem they have is the pipes underneath the streets. And yet, you know, we're putting out these morsels out there and saying we need to do water conservation. But it's, I don't know, to me it's unquantified. The last study I knew of, for example, just in Southeast Los Angeles, was in 1996. I helped conduct that study. And the infrastructure repairs needed to make that system efficient in five Southeast LA County cities was $50 million just for those communities. And so when I look at these numbers, you know, I'm thinking that there may be more that meets the eye, or at least something needs to be formalized so we can quantify the need.
And there certainly is, and one of the items that Deward spoke about with the cap and trade funding was for the water use efficiency activities. I believe one of the areas that's being looked at for that is just like what you're talking about, the water systems leakage from water systems. And if your system is leaking, you're losing water, you're having to pump, you're having to access more water, which obviously has an energy component, which obviously relates to, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. So that is one of the areas that's being looked at. Now, you know, is it going to address all $50 million in 1996 dollars at once? No, but I think it's a good step that way. With regard to IRWM and the 10%, I think to some extent it's a hard commitment of dollars, but with the understanding that the Integrated Regional Water Management Program is really going addressing multiple water management issues, regional priorities, regional needs. So to some extent, it likely falls short in some areas, but it locks in a commitment. It locks in a commitment, you know, over the future of a program as it moves. So. I don't know if that was a
no. That's fine. I've just been fishing for, you know, some quantification of all these numbers, because there's a lot of focus on these communities and there's nothing. And I mean, for example, I discovered a few weeks ago, Southern California Edison has a leak detection program that's supposed to be aimed at small systems. And as I understood it, they were having a difficult time reaching the smallest systems, and the systems that were applying for the funds were not the smallest and most inefficient. They were the ones that had the most capacity to actually go and apply for the funds. But if you kind of grouped all of these small ones together, you would probably end up with a lot more, but that's beside the point.
And it's timely that we're having the hearing on small systems in a couple weeks. Commissioner Heitz.
Casey, I appreciate this bond comparison. That's very interesting to see in that form. And I know there's a lot of discussion going on about the various proposed bond amendments, but what I would be interested in hearing from you is what are the drop-dead dates for getting changes made and getting this on the ballot in 2014?
I don't have the actual drop-dead dates. That is generally something that the Secretary of State, that comes from the Secretary of State, based on the timeline needed to get information out to local county registrars to update information. And that also is something that, with additional funding, can be expedited. I mean, that has happened in the past, where that date has pushed further and further. That just requires additional funding to expedite the processing of information. So I would be hesitant to give you a drop-dead date. I think the timeline I have heard from folks, not from within the administration, but from others talking about it, kind of coincides with the budget timeline. So, you know, end of June has been the timeline that has been tossed around, but like I said, I wouldn't carve that in stone.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Casey. Appreciate the update, and we'll look forward to hearing more as it progresses. We know it's very fluid.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Okay, number 9 on the agenda is our very own Spencer Kenner with a briefing on the area of origin issues involving Butte County and their claims to area of origin related to Oroville.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here, Spencer.
Thanks for inviting me, Chairman Byrne. I prefer to be on the dais, but I guess I don't have that choice. Pardon me? So one of the last meetings I was at, I was sitting where Maureen's sitting at the moment, and Commissioner Hintz asked me to brief you a little bit on the area of origin, and I thought I gave an adequate summary, but I guess that wasn't enough, so here I am back. So the drought, the area of origin seems to be on my mind lately. So I'm going to give you a quick summary of some of my remarks. Just to walk you through, this is a very complex area of law that's been around for a long time, since the early 30s, and more controversial more recently. So I'm going to try to give you a high-level review of sort of the background, the basis of the area of origin, and talk about a couple of cases that are more recent, the Tehama-Calusa Canal Authority case, which is in the Ninth Circuit, was decided by the Ninth Circuit, and the DWR case involving four contractors that sued the department that resulted in a settlement. I'll try to throw in some considerations with respect to the drought, since it's on my mind, with respect to that settlement and maybe some other considerations. But the theme is basically this morning, if you don't get anything more out of this, the theme is more, this is about rights, water rights and contract rights. And it runs through both the Tehama case, the DWR case from the outset, and the dispute as to what those rights are, depending on what side of the V, plaintiffs versus defendants V that you're on. So there are a set of statutes beginning in the 30s that were passed, collectively known as the area of origin, watershed of origin is another term that's used, to reassure users in the of water in the geographic area where they are that they won't be deprived of the water from where they are. So this was back in the 30s, even before the projects were in effect, perhaps even contemplated. But there are three that are really effective. The county of origin law from the 1931, the watershed protective statute of 1933, and the Delta Protection Act of 1959. These are all codified, still in effect, and have language that's still in dispute today. And these were primarily instituted on behest of the Northern California water users who were in the watershed that were afraid of losing their water to the South, the so-called North-South debate, which has, you know, as you know, is gone. We don't dispute that anymore. So we resolved that. But one of the cases has a quote I'd like to make here. Watershed or area of origin protective legislation was enacted during the formative years of the projects, meaning the CVP and the State Water Project, in order to alleviate the fear of Northern California interests that local water supplies would become depleted. And, of course, that's even becoming more apparent and more extreme now, this year, in the third year of a drought. The sort of the critical piece of the statute, and I'm talking about the area of origin statute for the state, is a confusing list of words that it's sort of a playground for lawyers, and there's been a lot of games played in with respect to this provision. I'm just going to briefly read it, just so you can see where the confusion is, or how it was begun. In the construction and operation of by the department, meaning the Department of Water Resources, of any project under the provisions of this part, a watershed or area of origin or area wherein water originates, the area of origin, or an area immediately adjacent thereto, which can conveniently be supplied with water therefrom, shall not be deprived by the department, directly or indirectly, of the prior right to all the water reasonably required to adequately supply the needs of that area. So tell me what that means. And what does it mean? Well, it depends on who you ask. I'll give you one explanation. Maureen would read this and give you another one. I can tell you that right now. Kim, as a lawyer, would give you another one. And Joe, the same. But fundamentally, there's two competing claims here. One is that just being in the area, this sort of geographic area, you're entitled to the water that flows there and is there, the natural flow. The other one is, and the one that the department has been taking, is that there needs to be some sort of affirmative action taken before you have a right to that water, even though you're geographically located there. So either you have to have a contract right, or you have to have a permit from the board, the water board. Those are sort of the two basic tent poles of this debate, and where really the conflict lies. In 1986, there were a series of decisions from Justice Roby, called the Roby decisions in the water board cases, and he had a lot to say about a lot of different things, and one of the things he described was, and what the department would call dicta, which is sort of, oh, by the way, let me just throw this in. It's not really the holding of the case. Others would say, no, it's part of the holding. I can see Commissioner Delfino nodding your head. So there's a little bit of a dispute there, but the language that he raised sort of gave rise to these two cases that have recently been filed. Not so recently now, but it suggests that the projects can't reduce contractors' water allotments unless there's something else out there that trumps the statute, that trumps the authority in the statute. And so nobody really knew what does trump the statute? What does that mean? Is it a different right? Is it some other authority? Is it meaningless? But Justice Roby usually doesn't say anything that doesn't have some meaning behind it. So that particular phrase and some other surrounding language in the case gave rise to what we think the filing of these cases. So the first case that I wanted to talk about really quickly was the Tehama-Calusa Canal Authority case. This was filed in federal court, so this isn't a state court case, but the judge penned the opinion, I'm sure you've all heard of Judge Oliver Wanger, an 88-page opinion, basically based his decision on state law, because that's where the law lies. There's no federal area of origin statute. It's the state area of origin. So even though we're talking about federal contractors in this case, it's really based on state law because that's where the authority lies. The plaintiffs in this case, plaintiff in this case, Tehama-Calusa, was asserting that the CDP contractors, as I was stating before, can claim the benefit of the statute, meaning the area of origin statute, that their allotment of water can't be reduced in order to so they can supply water to their outside users outside the area of origin. They quoted Roby saying that it makes clear that the Bureau cannot reduce the contractual allotment of water that the Canal Authority members are entitled to under their contracts in order to supply water for uses outside of the area of origin. So everything focuses in on the area of origin, where they are. They're entitled to it just because they're there. That's the argument that the Canal Authority was making. They took some of Roby's language that the department may say, well, okay, there's other interpretations of that, as I was saying earlier, maybe a little bit out of context, but there's an argument there. It made it all the way to the Ninth Circuit. The court held, and we're talking about the Ninth Circuit now, not just Judge Wanger. Judge Wanger agreed with the federal government, with the Department of Interior, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that the Canal Authority is not entitled to a preference and subject to shortage, even though they're in the area of origin. So even though they have a contract with the Department of Interior that talks about shortages, doesn't talk about the area of origin necessarily, but talks about shortages, even though they're in the area of origin, because they don't have a contract right or a water right, they're subject to the shortage provision of the contract, just like everybody else is. And that's sort of the fundamental argument there. There's a fundamental argument in the DWR case as well, that even though you're in the area of origin, you have to take some affirmative step to establish the right to the water there, beyond, say, a riparian right or an appropriative right. So absent some specific contract provision, which there wasn't, they're not entitled to an area of origin preference. That case has now been appealed as of January, I think, 10th of this year to the U.S. Supreme Court, and so it may make it to the Supreme Court. The state case, the DWR case, involved four plaintiffs: Butte County, Solano County Water Agency, Napa County, and Yuba City, that sued the department on these same grounds under the same statutes, asserting that notwithstanding the other, what would that be, 25 state water project contractors, there's 29 total, because of where they are located in the area of origin, they're entitled to their 100% state water project allotment before anybody else, even during times of drought, which, you know, which would be applicable today. So by contract, each state water project contractor has a certain allotment of water. They would be entitled to the 100% of that water before anybody else. The department obviously disagreed, asserting what I've already explained, that they needed to establish either a water right or a contract right, which they didn't do. And they're still subject to the shortage provision in the contract, the Article 18 of the State Water Project contract. So when there's a shortage, when the allotment can't be 100%, they are reduced just like everybody else, notwithstanding what Justice Roby may have said in his opinion. So we went into trial. There was discovery, trial prep. There was a motion for summary judgment that was denied on both sides, and the judge, in most people's view, both sides, sort of kicked the can down the road, didn't want to make the decision, so we ended up getting ready for trial. We started to mediate, which led to a settlement. And by the way, the settlement was just signed last week by Judge Height, so it's final. And so we'll sort of see where that leads. Now, the terms of the settlement are fairly complicated, and I just wanted to give you kind of a brief summary of what some of those terms are. But in no case does any of the settlement increase the allotment that the state will supply to these four plaintiffs. So they're what's called Table A, which is the amount of water that the state has contracted with these particular contractors. That stays the same. It's the same it's been since they signed their contracts back in the 60s. So that doesn't change. What it does do is it accelerates the delivery of that water during certain times of the year when they ask for it. So in a year like this, although this is such an extraordinary year, it might not even work this year, they would be entitled to ask for water in advance, or if there was natural flow that was otherwise available, they'd be entitled to that water. But again, limited by their contractual amount. So this is in sort of the policy side of this. This is a sort of a counterbalance to the north-south debate that it's the south always takes our water. Well, some of it's going to, as a result of this, some to four plaintiffs is going to remain in the north. There are restrictions, as everybody knows. The biological opinions restrict the movement of water south. The drought is restricting movement of water south. But to the extent that there's extra water or that there's water that would otherwise flow out of the delta, and to the extent that it's identifiable, they can ask for this water. Now, the total amount of water here is really de minimis. I think. I think the project has 2.4 million acre feet in it. We're talking less than 200,000 acre feet over a 5-year span. That's depending on the year, depending on when they ask for it, and the payback provisions, which are all part of the settlement agreement, which, by the way, are public, so folks can, if you're so inclined, or can pull those off the website and look at them, read them. So. One of the things I wanted to mention with respect to the drought was, and how the drought affects this settlement agreement. There are critical dry year considerations written into these settlement agreements, and of course, when we were drafting these things, there was, oh, this will never happen. Well, here we are; we're below 20%. There's a 20% sort of conference year provision in there that, in effect, would limit or eliminate any program under the settlement agreement. There would still be some provisions or some opportunity for water to move even in a critically dry year, but at the level that we're at now, it would be very difficult for any water to move under the settlement agreement. And if at all, it would be de minimis. We're talking 1,000, 2,000 acre feet, if anything. I think that's all I have in terms of the presentation. But I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, Commissioner Hintz. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer for you.
Commissioner DeBosque.
I'm not sure if you said this in your last statement, but does this have any bearing on transfers?
There is a limitation on transfers. Yes, it does. The sort of extra water that would be provided under the settlement agreement, any transfers could not touch that water. So they can't. Maybe I should say it the other way around. Transfers cannot use that water. So it has to stay within the basin. It has to stay within the area. It can't be transferred south. It can't be transferred. It can't be transferred south of the delta. If that's your question.
Well, I'm kind of thinking of voluntary transfers.
In terms of.
Well, there's a willing seller and a willing buyer.
Yeah, there are provisions in the settlement agreement that don't permit the plaintiffs to basically profit from the extra water that they're getting.
Mr. Curtin.
Could you touch on a Roby decision again? Because I didn't quite get the distinction that the Roby decision versus the Wenger decision. I don't know what I missed there, but how did the Roby decision come out more strongly for area of origin rights? Or maybe it didn't, but could you just go over that a little bit again?
Well, it really sort of left the door open, and Wenger slammed it shut. Oh. So
I understand that.
Yeah. But the language that Roby used, there's wiggle room in there to suggest that perhaps there is a right to water just because of where you're located. That you don't have to do anything extra. You don't have to go to the board. You don't have to have it in your contract. The DWR contracts talk about area of origin, but under DWR's position, you'd still have to go that extra step. Plaintiffs said, no, we were there. We're done. Just like what Roby said. So.
Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate it. It's a very complicated subject. Did a good job explaining it. It sounds like the area of origin issues are potentially still out there in the sense that we settled and it's not 100% resolved, but it is for purposes of the folks up there, and they get a little sweeter deal. We don't get impacts south of Delta, so it sounds like it's okay. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate coming in.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go quickly to number 10 on the agenda, which is Spencer's replacement, Maureen King, our legal counsel, who's going to do a very kind of brief and high-level overview of water transfers. She's got Maureen Sargent with her and also Tom Filler. And thank you all for being here. I know it's
good
appreciate it. This is something that I had requested a while ago to give us a better sense, especially given the drought, of how water moves around and restrictions in state contracts and kind of some general principles of movement that involves, or water transfers that involve, the state in some capacity.
Right. Good morning, commissioners. I'm switching hats here to my role as counsel in the Office of Chief Counsel, and one of my responsibilities is looking at all legal documents that involve water transfers in our dry year transfer program and certain other transfer programs. And I know that the commission has been interested in the piece that voluntary water transfers play in overall statewide water management, particularly in times of drought. So we thought it might be useful to give you some background information on how the Department of Water Resources addresses and is involved in water transfers on a year-by-year basis. And as such, we've put together a panel here of people who we all three work on water transfers as a team when we're moving them, and have put together sort of a primer, or Water Transfers 101, to give you the basics on. Maureen Sargent will address what a water transfer is and some of the water rights issues that water transfers are based upon. I'm going to give you a summary of the major legal considerations that we have when we do a water transfer. And then Tom Filler is going to address some of the recent initiatives that DWR has undertaken to facilitate water transfers and address some of the stressors in our water system right now using them. So let Maureen start.
Good morning. She said, my name is Maureen Sargent. I work in the department's State Water Project Analysis Office, and I got involved in transfers back in 1991 and have been involved in them off and on. And Our understanding and evaluation of transfers has evolved significantly from that time period as we learn more about transfers, how the water supply system works, and how some of these actions affect the water supply. And so for many people say water transfer and mean something very different than the person sitting next to them. So for the purposes of this, of my discussion right now, I'm going to talk about transactions between a willing buyer and or a willing seller and a willing buyer, where the seller will take certain actions to reduce the use on his property and transfer that water to a buyer downstream. You may hear of many other things called transfers, exchanges, intra-project, and I can touch on that a little bit at the end. But for the purposes of this, when we think of water transfers, we're thinking of something that shifts water from use in one place to use in another place. And so the most common types of actions taken to make water available for transfer are crop idling, where a farmer will idle some land that he would have planted otherwise, and he will transfer the water savings to someone downstream. Another very common one is groundwater substitution, and that's a case where a grower will continue to farm, or we have had some groundwater substitutions that involve municipalities, but the grower will pump groundwater, use that groundwater on their existing place of use. They don't transfer the groundwater directly. They use that groundwater in their place of use, and they transfer their surface water supply that they would have diverted. And that water is transferred to someone downstream. And the third most common type is reservoir reoperation. Someone such as Placer County Water Agency that has a reservoir, has surface storage rights, will release more water from their reservoir than they would have to serve just their local service area. And one of the biggest issues in evaluating a transfer is, I'm sorry, I guess I should be paying attention to, okay, thank you, is making sure that transfer is a responsible transfer, that you are not transferring water that would have otherwise been available to another user downstream of you and upstream of the new point of diversion. And that's where most of the complication lies. I know we hear so much about streamlining, the efforts to streamline transfers, and we're all interested in trying to do that to the extent we can. But we have to make sure that one component we don't omit is an analysis to make sure that what we're transferring is not going to injure someone else in the process. And so the key things that we try to look at, it won't injure another legal user of water, so another downstream user that has a legal right to water will not see less water in the water course than he would have if this transfer hadn't taken place. It won't unreasonably impact fish and wildlife or other in-stream uses. We wouldn't want to see a transfer that would seriously affect stream flow or water quality. And that one of the things that we have to look at as the department for transfers that want to use our facilities is whether it would unreasonably affect the economy of the area from which the water's coming, because it's very sensitive in Northern California. There's a fear that if we open up the market too much, you're going to see a drying up of the Sacramento Valley to serve other areas. So we have to be sensitive and look at that. And so we do a real water determination. We also include monitoring in each one of the transfers to try to make sure that these transfers are responsible transfers. So the big question is, you know, how do we determine real water? We have tried to make some improvements, and it's a question for a lot of people who want to do a transfer. Just how much do I have to transfer? So we have put together some information. Tom is going to talk a little bit more about some of that later, that gives some technical guidance. We have put together some checklists so that people can kind of go through and see what they need to do. First and foremost, you have to have a right to the water, whether it's an individual diversion right, a diversion right under a contract, and that right has to be transferable. In most cases, except for in-stream flow, riparian rights are not transferable. If you have a contract, there has to be a provision or the approval of you know, whoever you get your water from. And if you have an individual right, that right has to match the transfer. You can't have a water right to divert in the winter for, say, duck flood up and then propose to transfer water in the summer. So your water supply, your water right must match what you propose to do for the transfer. And in a year like this, an additional challenge is the water has to be there. You may have a right and you may use it every year, but this year, as you are probably aware, the Water Board is closely evaluating various watersheds, and they are going to be issuing notices of potential unavailability. If you are operating under an individual right and you get a notice of unavailability, there is no water to transfer. So we have to look at each one of those things, and we try to structure our conveyance agreements such that if conditions change, we can adapt to them. So every type of transfer, you evaluate a little differently to determine the real water. For crop idling, we need an accurate estimate of the amount of water that the crop would have consumed. The transfer is not based on how much water is diverted, and that is a very common misconception from people who have a water right. They think, I have a water right to 1,000 acre feet. I'm not going to use it, so I'm going to transfer 1,000 acre feet. Well, if you didn't transfer, you might have diverted 1,000 acre feet, but 300 acre feet come back. And that is available to those other legal users downstream. So we have to get an estimate of what the water supply would see with and without the transfer. And in crop idling, you know, you've got contributions to groundwater from deep percolation. The Sacramento Valley is absolutely interconnected. So if you transfer water that would have contributed to the water supply in one form or another, it will show up in the stream. So the common method for determining what's transferable under a crop idling scenario is the evapotranspiration of applied water. And that varies by crop, it varies by region, it varies by cultural practices. And there are a few crops that are a little more consistent, rice being one of them. And in recent years, that's the majority of the crop idling transfers we've seen have been rice. So we use averages. The only way to truly determine would be instrumentation, and it just isn't practical. So we have to make our best technical estimate. We have averages that we've developed, our land and water use people have looked at, and we use other technical publications. And we have a list of crops that we do accept for transfers. There are other crops that people would like to transfer, such as pasture. And unfortunately, the variability in the evapotranspiration is so broad. It can go from 0.8 to 3 acre-feet per acre. And without instrumentation, it's almost impossible to tell what that is. Other crops, like alfalfa, we might accept from one region, but if it's grown in the Delta, you've got access to water supply, and it's almost impossible to keep it from coming back. So we look at all of those things. We look at what the historic pattern is of their crops, because if they've grown tomatoes for 4 years in a row and they say, but I would have grown rice this next year, it's not likely that basing a water transfer on that would provide a realistic estimate of what the amount of transferable water is. And the land that's idled has to stay idled. We conducted a demonstration project in the Delta because of the experience we had in our 1991 drought water bank to see just how much water was actually made available by idling within the Delta lowlands. This was one of the lowland islands. And the groundwater is so high, the weeds are so aggressive, that they estimated they would make 2.7 acre-feet per acre available. They made 0.5. And so if you are requesting someone to move that water, that's a huge difference in what the estimate of actual water is. And so there are certain areas where we have to look very closely, certain areas where we might have to require instrumentation versus just an estimate of the average. And keeping the land idle was a near impossible task. We have pictures of a gentleman I used to work with who's 6 foot tall, and he is standing in weeds up to his neck on one of the Delta Islands. So it can be a significant challenge. For groundwater substitution, we did not used to have a stream flow depletion factor. We have learned that if we don't account for the change in stream flow as a result of additional pumping, that we are transferring more water than was actually made available. So since we recognize that the system is interconnected, we try to make an estimate of how much the additional pumping will affect the stream system during balance conditions when it matters. We know that if you pump groundwater, it eventually comes at the expense of surface water in one way or another. But if it comes during excess conditions, that's good for everyone. If it comes during balance conditions, when the projects are either releasing additional water or there's just enough water for everyone, then it's going to come at the expense of someone else. We need, we have criteria on where you can put your well because that affects how strongly that well might influence the surface water. That's a determination of location. If it's close or shallow, has a much bigger or more rapid effect than if it's far away and deep, and the aquifer parameter. So we have criteria that look at that. We also require that there be an accurate flow meter. We found that in prior transfers, some of them were off by 20%, which it makes a significant difference when you're asking someone else to move it. In a reservoir reoperation, you need to know that that is going to be water that would be released, that would not be released in the absence. So we ask for historic records, things to demonstrate that this is new water that wouldn't be there otherwise. And then reservoir reoperation transfers are a little unique in that the impact to downstream users is not during the year of the transfer, but it's in a following year. If you create a bigger hole in your reservoir because you're releasing water you would not have, you're going to fill up water. You're going to fill up with stream flow that would have flowed downstream the following year, but for that extra hole. So we add what we call refill requirements, criteria, so that the refilling of that hole that was a result of the transfer happens at a time when others are not impacted. All these go to making sure that the two parties that are involved in the transfer are the ones that absorbed the impacts of that transfer. Some of the other types you will hear about or see but are not as common, conservation transfers, they come up frequently because conservation, on-farm conservation is a very big issue right now, but not all conservation measures make water available for transfer, and that's hard for some people to understand. But if you do things like just reduce your tailwater, it may make your system more efficient, you reduce pesticide discharges, things like that. So they're very beneficial, but if you're cutting off the return flow, you're cutting off water that would have gone to someone, been available to someone downstream. So it doesn't necessarily generate transferable water. Crop shifting is one where you might shift from, we had an instance where they shifted from corn to wheat or something like that, a higher water use to a lower water use, and that change in consumptive use savings is the transferable water. It doesn't happen as often because the economics are not as favorable. And then in-stream dedication is another one that we see a little bit. It doesn't really create new water supply, but it has some environmental benefits, and that's the one case where riparian rights are actually transferable. In many of these cases, and where DWR gets involved, you need conveyance facilities to get it from the seller to the buyer. And when it has to move across the delta, we get a request to convey that water. And Water Code Section 1810 says that an owner of a public facility has to provide conveyance capacity if it's available. And the department is more than happy, very interested in using the transfers to the extent possible to really improve water management. But it's limited, of course, by our capacity. And as you're all aware, right now, that capacity is constrained by so many different factors. We have our biological opinions, our water rights decision, D1641. And so when we're constrained, in other times of the year, we have to put more of that water into the limited transfer window, which according to our biological opinions is July through September. And in years like this, we have lots of capacity because we are not moving project water. But we have other things that will constrain our ability to pump water, water quality, outflow requirements. So our operators will make an estimate of what's available, and requests come into the department. They come to the State Water Project Analysis Office, and we evaluate, along with staff from our regional offices, we evaluate those, and we develop a conveyance agreement that will have all the requirements. And the seller and the buyer are both party to those agreements. And we move the water, like I said, July through September. It either has to be on pattern, if it's a direct diversion right, or if there's storage available, then, of course, we can coordinate with the transfer party. And I had mentioned earlier that we consider these the typical type what people think of as transfers. Many other things are thrown out there. You'll see big numbers, like 1.2 to 1.7 million acre-feet of transfers a year. When you hear those numbers, it's not these, say, north to south or willing buyer to seller, where the seller takes, you know, some land out of production to move it to another one. Most of those are, say, inter-project transfers. The CVP has a very active exchange program or transfer program among its contractors. It doesn't make new water available. It's a reallocation of what reclamation is determined in that year it can provide. The department has something similar under its contracts. And then there's also inter-project exchanges. The Department of Water Resources and Bureau of Reclamation will allow exchanges of project supply so that their contractors can, say, get water out of underground storage. Some contractors may have water in storage that is downstream of their location, say, semi-tropic. Water doesn't flow upstream, so they'll do an exchange with the State Water Project contractor to get some of their water back. Those are inter-project exchanges that, again, don't make the pot of water bigger, but they allow a more efficient use of what's available. Our consolidated place of use petition that we recently filed is in that category. It's a way to have the most efficient use of existing project supplies. It doesn't generate new project water.
Thank you, Maureen. That's very helpful. It builds right into Maureen.
Yeah, I think it's best if we wait till the end for questions,
yeah,
because these are
good.
Kind of three parts of the puzzle.
Yeah, and I acknowledge also that we have, we probably could talk about this for hours and hours, and I'd almost like to, but we do have a limited amount of time as well, so I do appreciate rolling through.
Okay, I'm going to focus on the legal mechanisms that apply when we move water in the category of transfers that Maureen Sergeant was focusing on, which is a willing buyer and a willing seller. And the legal touchstone for all water transfers is something that Maureen talked about. It's that they can't be conducted in a manner that injures other legal users of water. We call this the no-injury rule. And under this cardinal principle of water transfers, it's you can't do it if somebody downstream is going to be negatively impacted by the transfer. And one of the things that this also means is that you can't transfer more acre footage of water than you are legally entitled to transfer. And this leads us into something else that Maureen talked about from an operational perspective, which I'll talk about from a legal perspective, which is called the real water determination. And that's really going to, the case of a crop idling transfer, what proportion of your irrigational water that you're not using is actually transferable, because, as Maureen said, some of it sinks into the ground and would otherwise go to other users. So you have to take those things into account. And if a water transferor in a real water determination, if a transfer proposes to transfer more water than they are legally entitled to, it's going to impact someone else. And so the evaluation that we do is based on a net addition of water to the downstream system that the transferor is making available by its saving and its consumptive use. And That's the key thing, and the consumptive use can be saved in a variety of ways in different types of transfers. And project agencies, both the SWP and the CVP, are the last diverters in the Sacramento and San Joaquin River system. And a real water determination, the key component is that you need to have a baseline against which you measure the savings in water, and the baseline for a real water calculation is the amount that would have been available downstream at the historic point of diversion if you had not done the water transfer. And again, Maureen touched on this. And the important thing that in the math is that the volume of water that's transferred can't exceed the amount of demonstrated reduction in consumptive use, or in the case of streamflow, augmentation of the streamflow by the transferor. And those conservation measures can happen by release from storage in the case of reservoir reoperation transfers, from crop shifting, which Maureen talked about, groundwater substitution transfers, which are a major type that we deal with in a typical dry year, as well as crop fallowing. And it's important to understand the legal issues as they impact DWR and water transfers, that we actually have a very limited role. We are generally not the buyer, we are not the seller of the water, nor are we the negotiator of the price per acre footage for the water that's going to be transferred. And as noted earlier, when DWR conveys water for what's known in the water code as a bona fide transferor, it's subject to Section 1810 of the Water Code. And as Maureen pointed out, Section 1810 of the Water Code creates a mandate that if capacity is available in the State Water Project system, we have to make it available to a bona fide transferor. However, this obligation is subject to DWR being able to make certain determinations regarding that specific transfer. And a bona fide transferor is an entity that has, one, a contract for sale of water, and two, that sale is conditioned upon the acquisition of a conveyance facility to get the water from the buyer to the seller. And that's where DWR comes in. And our legal nexus coming in there is in the context of a conveyance agreement. That's the contractual mechanism we use. And the 1810 determinations which have to be made in order for this conveyance capacity to be available for a water transfer go to both environmental and economic considerations, and they are spelled out in Section 1810D of the Water Code. And again, the no injury rule comes in here, and you have to be able to show that you're not going to injure another legal user of water, and also that you will not unreasonably affect fish, wildlife, or other in-stream beneficial uses. And finally, you have to also ensure that you're not going to injure the economy of the area of origin from the transfer. And DWR has to make written findings in these for the 1810 determinations in every single transfer in which they're applicable. And it's noteworthy that these determinations are also made, and I'll get to this in a minute, but certain one-year temporary transfers are exempt from CEQA. But even if they are exempt from CEQA, they're still, if we're going to wheel the water, they're subject to these environmental and economic considerations. And CEQA for water transfers, typically long-term water transfers, which are defined as transfers that span more than 1 year, are subject to CEQA, and the seller of the water is typically the lead agency under CEQA. And DWR, as the conveyor and the buyer, are responsible agencies. And short-term water transfers of less than a year, in contrast, of post-1914 water rights are exempt from CEQA under Section 1729 of the Water Code. But as I just pointed out, even though they don't get CEQA, they do get the 1810 review. And then short-term transfers of pre-1914 water rights are subject to CEQA. And again, seller is typically the lead agency and DWR the responsible one. And the CEQA, in the case of most of these one-year transfers, takes the form of an initial study and a negative declaration. And you've heard me talk about the pre-1914 and post-1914 divide in water law, and that's a jurisdictional issue that goes back to the fact that the Water Code as we know it now and the Water Board as we know it now came into being in 1914 and did not bring in pre-existing water rights into the board's jurisdiction. So they are typically, not completely, but typically exempt from most Water Board jurisdiction. And both pre- and post-1914 water rights are subject to the 1810 determinations if the use of our conveyance facilities is sought. And Maureen's already touched on the distinction between appropriative and riparian water rights and transfers, so I'm not going to say any more about that right now. And it's just worth noting, too, that in the case of pre-1914 rights, common law also imposes some restrictions. There's a no-injury concept in common law that would also apply to those. And in summary, the transfer of post-1914 water rights get State Water Board and DWR review if our conveyance facilities are used, if we wheel the water. Pre-1914 water transfers are not subject to the Water Board review, but they are subject to CEQA and common law. And any water transferred that's conveyed by DWR or by DWR for the SWP facilities is predicated upon DWR being able to make the requisite 1810 findings about the environment and the economy. And finally, I wanted to add that both CISA and ESA apply to the participants in the water transfer, particularly to the seller who has most of the information about the conditions around which the where the water is found. So I'm going to sign off here and turn it over to Tom.
Good morning, commissioners. Thanks for this opportunity. I'm Tom Filler. I work in the Water Transfers Program, DWR. Today, I just want to present to you the status of both some of the near-term and long-term actions that DWR is taking to help facilitate water transfers. Some of what I'm presenting to you will probably look familiar to you from the presentation that Deputy Bardini gave last fall. And what I'm doing is kind of what I said, a status update of where we're at to help facilitate transfers. Basically, DWR is taking the initiative to implement management actions to facilitate water transfers as directed in the Executive Order B-2113, the California Water Action Plan, and more recently, the Governor's Drought Proclamation. With those requirements, we're moving forward. But I also want to mention that we're also meeting with buyers and sellers and other various state and federal agencies to help coordinate in the facilitation of transfers. And a lot of what you're going to see in what I'm going to be touching on is a direct result coming out of those meetings and some of the recommendations that they've made we're implementing at this time. So what I've got here is kind of an overview, a larger picture of what we're doing for process improvements. Basically, we're improving contracting procedures for transfer that are dependent on state water project facilities, facilitating or fast-tracking water transfers with appropriate supporting documentation for 2014, and, as I mentioned, improving coordination and alignment with other agencies, both state and federal. We're also updating our web information. We've provided a lot of recent information on our website for outreach tools. We've also provided graphics detailing some of the water movement in the last couple of water years, showing where the water is coming from, where it's going to, and for example, ag to ag or ag to municipal and industrial. Percentages and kind of where it's moving. So that was one of the requests that came from the drought task force. And yeah, it is important to note that we're doing all we can to help facilitate transfers in this very dry year. Also, I wanted to mention that we're working in coordination with both the State Board and the Bureau of Reclamation as a clearinghouse approach to have a one-stop shop to where people can look at transfer, formal transfer proposals that have come in, so people can go there and see and get updates on what's happening in the transfer world. That's still in development at this time, but we hope to have something up pretty soon. To date, we haven't received any formal transfers. For DWR, I'm not sure about any of the other agencies. Looking here for the public outreach tools, what we have is you've got a handout of this. It's a two-page handout. And basically what this is basically a description of DWR's role in water transfers and also some of the near and longer-term actions that we're taking. As I mentioned before, a lot of those actions came out of recommendations that we've obtained during our meetings with the buyers, sellers, and other agencies. Again, for short-term improvements, you may have saw this earlier during Deputy Director Bardini's presentation. Basically, we've developed an at-a-glance process and schedule broken out into four steps, basically for when the technical information coming out for each year for water transfers. And then when proposal development is needed, the review process, and then looking at operations and verification of the transfers that are being made in that year. Recently, due to the nature The extreme nature of this year, we revised the process and schedule to provide additional opportunity for transfer proponents to submit their applications early or their proposals early for review. Again, as I mentioned, we have not received anything to date as a formal proposal. A lot of inquiries, but no formal proposals. For 2014 fast tracking, some of the work that we're doing to expedite transfers is to expedite any transfers that are similar to transfers that were approved in 2013. And regarding the 2013 work, we haven't made any changes to the technical document or significant changes anyways as far as the technical information that is needed to be submitted in transfer proposals. It's the same as it was in 2013 for 2014. We're also accepting wells that were previously approved by DWR for groundwater substitution transfers if they were approved between the window of 2009 through 2013. So the transfer participants this year don't have to do any additional work. This may not hold true for future years, but for 2014, due to the critical nature, we thought it would be a good idea just to help transfer proponents in their preparation. Also, the stream flow depletion factor for groundwater substitution transfers is not changing in 2014. As I mentioned, that will remain the same as 2013. Moving on to some longer-term management strategies and improvements. A lot of these are similar to what we're doing in the short term and just continuing those out. We're going to continue to conduct public outreach and with stakeholders to foster transparency for transfers and continue to provide detailed information about water transfers. Make that available through public outreach meetings and also through our web interactions. Just to speak about web interaction, our website's going through a facelift. It should have something out within the next couple of weeks, so the interface should be a little bit easier to use, hopefully a little more user-friendly. Also, for longer term, for technical operational administrative rules, we want to continue to improve those efficiencies for the internal review process, the contracting process, and water transfers operation and verification methods in any way that we can. Again, we'll be, working with folks, both the agencies and buyers and sellers, to improve that over time. Continuing on with long-term management improvements, we're going to continue to develop and periodically update the technical guidance for the different types of water transfers that Marine Sergeant had talked about earlier: cropland island, groundwater substitution, reservoir reoperations. I think it's important that we continue that work in refining the work for each one of those transfers to get a real idea and understanding about how much water is being generated when it comes to specific transfers. Environmental and local ordinance considerations. Currently, the Bureau of Reclamation is working in coordination with San Luis Deltaman and Dota Water Authority in developing a long-term environmental document, and we're coordinating with them and cooperating with them in that development in some of the research and providing them information with some of the studies that we've been doing recently to help them improve their document. Also, working with local ordinances or local agencies such as Butte County and others to address any concerns they may have for transfers that were originating out of their areas. And then for operational transfer system, again, we're going to continue to develop tools and our analytical capabilities to better determine the transfer capacity and timing that people maybe give a better understanding and reduce some of the uncertainty over the course of time as our tools get better, so people have a better idea whether there'll be capacity available or not to to actually move transfer water. As you heard earlier, there's a lot of constraints on when we can move transfer water, and it's in, there's a lot of competition for that capacity. Also, you know, water management, our systems management, and you know, estimating the amount of water that might be available this year has really been tricky because of potential for curtailments, and we'd like to have a better handle on evaluating that in the future if we can. And then just improving transfer management overall in general. So one more thing for long-term management improvements. We'd like to kind of develop a set of documents instead of having one document. You may be aware of the 2014 technical guidance document that's out there. It's a compact, nice document, but we thought it might be better to have like a policy guidance process document for step-by-step guidance on how to get people through the process, including checklists that we have currently on the website, kind of the where, when, and how, and then breaking out the technical guidance documents for each type of water transfer, major type, and providing that technical information separately in different documents so people would not have to search through the entire document to find what they might need. They could just grab one of those pamphlets, if you will, and or brochures, and go through that very rapidly and figure out what they need. And that about summarizes what I have. And for additional information on transfers, you can go to our website and find a lot more information there.
Thank you very much, Tom. Excuse me. I've got a quick kind of question, make sure I understand. So, and by the way, Maureen, very, very helpful. And I was thinking the context of, so the state gets involved in the no injury analysis and the 1810 findings when you have an issue that involves a state facility and you're moving water through a state facility. Are there most commonly?
Sorry.
Yeah. What would be the other instances in which you'd be doing an analysis? I mean, it could, I assume, be between contractors as part of the state project or not. Or
again, it's different. The analysis is very different if it's an exchange between contractors because they have the ability to, you know, they've got an allocated amount from the, except
right.
this year. Hopefully they will at some point. But they've got an allocated quantity of water that they can exchange with, you know, their mechanisms for exchanging some of that water. We get involved in doing a real water analysis if we are going to be moving the water between two different sellers. Or one other case time we do get involved is if there is a transfer proposed that is not going to use our facilities, but it might impact our water rights. So it's a different role. It's in protecting the State Water Project's water rights. And so we would get a notice from the State Water Resource Control Board of a proposed transfer, and we would look at that transfer proposal to see if we felt that it was real water and maybe comment to the board that we felt it was, the quantities were more than what was going to be made available.
So then if you had, and that's very helpful, if you had an example of someone who's maybe, you know, foregoing groundwater up in the Central Valley and they want to set it down, it's going to go through the state system. You might do your evaluation or 810 findings, and you might as well look at it if it potentially has some impacts to your water rights or the state's water rights.
Excuse me. It's essentially the same analysis we would do.
Okay.
So we do comment. We're coordinated in a coordinated fashion with the State Water Resource Control Board. They would post a notice, and we would provide comments if we felt that the analysis was overly optimistic or something like that. So the board would likely consider that in its analysis of the transfer as well.
And from a purely legal perspective, the Section 1810 and the determinations under 18D would not come into effect unless there's a bona fide transfer or, and that would not apply to these intra-agency exchanges of water. It only applies when you have somebody who is not, you know, they need the contractual capacity to move the water from the buyer to the seller. And if they're moving it between two SWP contractors, they have provisions in their long-term water supply contracts now that permit that. So you don't get into the 1810 in those non-transfer.
And the same thing with, say, if we find that GCID is going to transfer some water to someone on the Tamakosa Canal, we would not get involved in that. That is like similar to the exchanges of our project supply. That's an exchange of State Water Project I mean, Central Valley Project Supply. And so it's looked at differently.
Commissioner Ortega, and I'm sorry.
Could it be said that in your review, when you do like the conservation type of not the fallowing, but more mm-hmm. of the water use efficiency kind of thing, that you're really verifying conservation, you're verifying it is in addition to seeing if the water is really available and doing everything else you do, that this is really a savings?
Exactly. There is actually a transfer from Browns Valley Irrigation District that was initiated a number of years ago. They used to provide water from their reservoir to their service area through an unlined, very old unlined ditch. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of riparian vegetation that had grown up alongside the canal, which was supported by water from the canal, very inefficient. They replaced that with a pipe, and they didn't get to transfer all of the water that had percolated, but what they did do is they were very proactive. They went and they took pictures and calculated how much that riparian vegetation had consumed, and then so consequently what the savings were, the consumptive use savings were from that conservation measure, and they are entitled to transfer that quantity of water, and they do that on a routine basis.
Well,
and it's an ongoing.
The reason I ask is because I know that a lot of the discussion on transfers centers around agriculture, and when I listen to you, what you're really articulating is a flexible system, and you're defining the boundaries of that flexibility based on real water that's available. During the drought and even before that, we have vast sections of the state that purportedly have done all kinds of great things on water conservation, but you don't see it come up in terms of flexibility within their systems. And in fact, you look at some econometric models, for example, of the conservation that's celebrated in Southern California, and they'll tell you that it could have been just as equally attributable to the slow economy. And if we really had it, for example, if we really had those water molecules, you would be able to do an exercise similar to the one that you've done, and you would be able to move that water from an area that doesn't have water to an area that doesn't, with no impact on the overall water supply.
That's correct. So particularly with conservation, everyone is looked at individually. Another type of conservation measure that can make water available for transfer is if you reduce the discharge to a unusable sink. We had another case that was in the San Joaquin Valley where they put in conservation measures. What it did was it reduced the saline drainage to the San Joaquin River. That improved the water quality of the San Joaquin, required less dilution flow from another freshwater source. So you really were saving, you're making real water available. The system saw additional water supply as a result of those actions.
And that's a key message, I think, because so much you hear right now when it comes to how we're going to get out of the drought and the idea that we could take the water from agriculture, when, in fact, I think there's efficiencies that agriculture can demonstrate and quantify that other parts of the state should be equally able to as well with their own efficiency. That's my only point.
Commissioner Delfino.
So I just had a really quick question, and this was for Maureen Sargent. When you were giving your presentation, you said that idle land must be maintained free of excess vegetation. But I thought that there was legislation that went through last year that allowed for upland bird habitat to be maintained in certain circumstances.
And this, the issue of excess vegetation creates so much confusion. And I should have defined what we consider excess vegetation, because excess vegetation is not any vegetation. There are many areas. Lundberg, for example, has transferred water. He grows a cover crop for his normal cultural practices in the winter, and then when he participated in a water bank, he requested to be able to leave that on the idle field over the summer for habitat. And as far as we're concerned, that's great. We don't require that they disc the ground, because where he's located, you don't have a real high groundwater table. That vegetation is dry during the summer. It's not consuming the water that you're proposing to transfer. So we don't consider that excess vegetation. When we say excess vegetation, we're talking about the lush green field that's, I mean, literally the one example I used was in the Delta. they just could not keep the vegetation down. It used nearly as much water as the crop that they were idling. And so, yes, absolutely, we have no issue with leaving vegetation on the idled fields, as long as it is the type of, it can be native vegetation, it can be a earlier cover crop, as long as it's not consuming the water that you're proposing to transfer.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify, because yes. I knew that that had moved through, and I knew that was a big issue. I understand the explanation you're giving about the delta. I actually just drove through on Highway 160 and was pointing out to my children, see, that's where the river is, and that's where they're growing. And I can see why they would have trouble keeping
it. And it was actually our policy before the legislation was introduced, but I think there was just so much confusion, and there was a fear that they had to leave the land bare, and it's always been at the option. We don't require that they leave vegetation. It's at the option of the grower, but we are certainly don't have a problem with them doing that.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that we've had some inquiries about that, and that in our technical information document, we've been asked to clarify that language a little better. We've been working, or I'm in contact with Mark Henley at California Waterfowl Association. We'll be looking at that closely. They said they could actually provide some resources, you know, as far as staff to maybe help us craft some additional language that might better suit their purposes, too.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. It's really something that I've been trying to get more information on. Commissioner Kurtz got a question.
I just have a quick question. Yeah. Do we charge for the wheeling in this process?
That depends on who you are. If you are a state water project contractor moving non-project water, you're already paying for those facilities. If you are not a state water project contractor, you do pay use of facilities charges.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Okay. Anybody else? Thank you. I think I may have follow-up questions at some other time, but I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's really very thorough and very informative and helpful to kind of put it all together as we're going through what we're going through right now. Thank you. Okay, moving on to the last items on the agenda, I think, are just Sue, and they'll be very quick.
They will be very quick.
Item number 11. Sue.
I wanted to let you know that we had solicited comments on our staff draft regulation and guidelines for the public benefits of water storage projects. We received 5 sets of formal comments back, 3 from private citizens, 1 from the Bureau of Reclamation, and 1 from Fiat Water Agency. We also had a couple of people that had had conversations with me and may be submitting formal comments later. We're going to bring those back to the commission in March with Ajay Goyal and with the consultants to make some recommendations. I thought I would just, they kind of fall into 8 categories. I thought I would just mention those for you today. The first were kind of requests for more clarity and detail on our decision-making process. For example, how would the commission select the panel members? How would those panel member recommendations be factored into the decision? What's the role of the Department of Fish and Wildlife and State Board in the evaluation process? The second one, there were some suggestions about changing what's on the priority lists, current priority lists of the Department of Fish and Wildlife and State Board, and obviously this is something that we would have to coordinate with those agencies if it's a desire of the Commission. There were also some requests that additional information be requested in the regulation or guidelines. There may be a role for that. There may also be that this information is included in things like feasibility studies or in environmental impact reports, so we may want to clarify that. Some questions about clarifying the distinction between eligible public benefits and non-public benefits. For example, whether water temperature is a water quality or an ecosystem benefit, when recreation or ecosystem benefits observed outside the delta might count, and when indirect water supply improvements might count as public benefits. So we'll go through there. A few comments about how these regulations would relate to other existing laws, for example, the Delta Reform Act or reclamations laws. 6, requests for clarifications regarding specific economic assumptions. I won't even begin to talk about what those are. We'll have Steve and Roger talk about discount rates and accounting perspective next month. some questions which I know we have talked about here about how to quantify and include system-wide benefits. It's been a desire of this commission that be factored in. So there were some comments and some suggestions along those lines, and then just some general changes in wording or phrases for clarification. So we will bring those back next month with, again, some recommendations and have a discussion about that with you at that time. The final agenda item, number 12, has to do with our small systems drought workshop in Southern California on Monday, March 3rd. We are in the process of putting that agenda together, finalizing that. At the moment, we have representatives from the state's drought task force, as well as the federal drought program. We have invited representatives from both the state and the local environmental health departments that deal with drinking water systems. We have representatives from the California Rural Water Association and the California Association of Mutual Water Companies. We have both of the co-chairs invited for the disadvantaged community and EJ caucus that have worked on the state water plan, and those individuals both have other day jobs that have to do with helping communities that are disadvantaged with their water systems. And then we've extended some invitations to individual water system managers for some of the smaller systems in Southern California. I have also talked with Anacita about including tribal interests, and we may be able to do that either as part of the meeting or in a separate discussion before or after the meeting that day. We will notice the agenda this Friday, and we'll contact all of you in terms of arrangements for those of you that are able to make that. This will be, again, Monday, March 3rd, and it will be an afternoon workshop starting at 1 o'clock, going to probably about 4:30 or 5 to allow people to get down there and back in the same day. So just wanted to mention that.
That sounds good.
Next
Number
month?
13, let's do it. Let's wrap her up, yeah.
Next month, as I mentioned, we'll bring back the comments on the public benefit regulations that staff's been working on. We should also have ready for your final approval the state water project encroachment regulations. And I think we're probably due for an update to you on salt and sea issues and activities. So those are what we have on our list. We'd be happy to work with the chairman or any of the other commission members on any additional items for the March meeting.
We're going to have something on water quality as well. I think we had.
Yeah, I would like to work with you on that.
Okay.
Thanks. Great.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Sue. Any questions, anyone? Great. Yeah, hopefully we can make it. I think it's nice to go to a different part of the state and represent. It was fun going up to Butte when we did. Okay. Item number 14, public comments. Seeing none, moved to item 15 and a motion to adjourn. Moved. Second, all those in favor?
Aye.
Great. We're adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.